And this is Lena Life. I'm Lena Mirmont. I'm having my show today with very special and particularly very noble person. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Schneider. For some reason, one thought came to my mind of one saying, "It is not titles that honor men, but men that honor titles." I, however, must say that Dr. Schneider has both. She has an honor, and she's certainly very impressive with her titles. Welcome.
Thank you, Lena.
I like to introduce somewhat the frame of our show. It certainly will be around your work, which has to do with the most sensitive and very difficult for discussion area. It is extremely clandestine subject, yet sharply relevant and extraordinarily important. We will be discussing sexual addictions. I certainly had a tremendous honor, privilege, and learned so much from your two books. They are twins, I call them. One is Disclosure Secrets, and the other one is Surviving Disclosure. As I call twin books, written by Dr. Schneider and her colleague by Deborah Corley. I like to also mention something which I did before we had this very undesirable break, that the shape of this program will have roughly three parts. We will be talking about Dr. Schneider's experiences, some background, what prompted her to write those fundamental books on the subjects which I mentioned, which I will mention in a second. Then we will be talking about the books and certain ideas and positions, concepts, and of course where you listeners can get those books. And then closer to the second part or to the end, we will be talking about extremely fascinating subject, also quite painful subject, regarding, again, Dr. Schneider's personal experience with a certain negative use of one drug which connected to the osteoporosis. So just for your listeners to know that we have quite enriched program with the different ideas. And just in case if you did miss the first introduction or have hard time to connect the introduction before the break, I would again say that my extremely noble and special guest, Dr. Jennifer Schneider, is a specialist, thinker, and a person who had courage and sensitivity with depth to talk about sexual addictions, as I mentioned before. Very difficult subject to talk about, clandestine in its nature, and yet so relevant and important to all of us. Dr. Schneider, to begin with, a bit about your background. What particularly prompted you to be in a such importantly sensitive field for all of us with this subject and this problem of the society as a sexual addiction?
Well, what prompted me, Lena, was a personal experience in that early in my marriage, this is many years ago, I learned that my husband had had an affair, and then he admitted that he had had several affairs. And I knew in his first marriage, before he met me, that that marriage had ended because he had had multiple affairs. He didn't understand what was happening, and really neither did I, until he came across an article about sex addiction, which back then, so many years ago, nobody had ever heard of. And he recognized that his behavior which was compulsive and repeated, was like a person who is a drug addict who needs their drug to feel okay. And with him, he needed that getting that good feeling from having other women be interested in him. So he recognized that this was a behavioral addiction, kind of like gambling, and he got help for it and suggested that I get help for it, like in Al-Anon. You know, alcoholics, their spouses go to Al-Anon where they get help for themselves because they have been very negatively impacted by living with an addict. So that is how I started learning about addiction, and eventually I became certified in addiction medicine because I was and am a physician and very interested in researching this subject and writing about it, especially from the perspective of partners. Let me say that this was in the early 1980s, a long time ago. Now we have so many politicians in high places in the government who are demonstrating all the same kind of thing, out-of-control behavior, affairs. They're using the internet now, that people have heard much more about sex addiction than they did back then. So in a way, it's easier.
Thank you profoundly for sharing your personal story. I honestly would not enough praise you for being so open. It is so helpful, particularly because your accomplishments truly remarkable. You are a scientist, you're a doctor, you're a human being, you're a parent. So you probably internalize this issue in so many levels. I like to connect to some of your positions in the book and some of the chapter. And since you brought to our attention your personal story, I like to start literally from the beginning of your book of disclosing secrets, the power of disclosure, because this is such a tremendously difficult step, and mostly people, at least in my observation, and actually I recall certain things I read about in your book, these people in most times very weak, fragile, emotionally tormented, scared, and terribly vulnerable. How can we address, and where would we start to approach this issue?
Well, spouses of sex addicts often have a background where they themselves had some issues regarding how good they feel about themselves. And that's not true for everybody. There are healthy women who are married, or men, I mean, we're talking about both genders, who are married to somebody who is a sex addict, and the partner themselves is a healthy person. But even if you start out that way, you can't help taking it personally. It's not like alcoholism, where if somebody drinks a lot, it doesn't feel personal. But if someone is having affairs with other people, or if they're so busy having sex online on the internet, which is how things go these days, that they're not interested in making love to their spouse, I mean, you can't help but take it personally and feel bad. So the partner does need support and understanding of what a traumatic experience they've been through. And there are therapists who are trained specifically in working with partners and with sex addicts and with couples. Now, let me just say that you know, I'd just like to give you for a moment a definition of addiction, because some of you may be confused about why I'm calling this an addiction. You know, addictions of all kinds, whether to drugs or to behaviors, have certain characteristics in all of them, and they include, first of all, a loss of control. And with drinking, you know, you intend to drink two beers and you drink five or six, that kind of thing. You say you're going to stop, but you're not. And the same thing with smoking. A lot of you know about how hard it is to stop smoking. It's a compulsive behavior. And it's the same thing with the behavior of sex addicts. That's the first component, the compulsive behavior, the loss of control. And then you have the how it affects their mind, in that they're spending all their time thinking about how to get this drug or the substance or the latest woman or the next picture on the internet. And so that becomes the most important thing in their life, more important than their spouse or their partner. So it's the compulsiveness, the loss of control, and also the continuation despite negative consequences, like bad things happen to them, but they're still doing it, and then thinking about it all the time. If you have those elements present, you have an addiction, and it affects the family as well as the person. And that's why the help for it consists of counseling, including reading books and stuff like that, but also attending programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, of which there are plenty, for sex addiction as well. My books, Disclosing Secrets and Surviving Disclosure, are specifically about an early part of this. The early part is that you really, for an addict to recover, they have to start out by being honest with the spouse, and that is a very, very difficult and painful process, and that's where a therapist can help, and that's where these books can also help also. You know, I'd like to tell you a personal experience about disclosure. I told you that my husband had had some affairs, and when I found out about it, I had a lot of questions, and I asked him, for example, I remembered about a trip we took one weekend where he just kept acting so mean, and the more, you know, I would say things like, "You're so nice to me because we're doing this and this," and then he would say something really hurtful. And I couldn't understand it. And then later, when we were talking about, when he was disclosing to me about his affair, he told me that whenever I said something to him like, "You're a nice person," he felt so guilty, because he knew that he was really, you know, thinking about the other woman, that in a way he had to let me know that he was not a nice person, and that's why he was being so awful to me. And it was so helpful to me to understand this, to be able to get validation for the fact that I wasn't the one who was crazy or was causing the problem or whatever. So that one of the big things about disclosure is it validates the partner's perceptions. She doesn't think she's crazy. She knows that what she was feeling was real, and maybe he was lying to her and things like that. So disclosure is very important.
You, in a sense, read my mind a little bit, because when I looked at the history of the sex addiction formulation, or where it was established as a field, even though it goes very, very far, nearly with the birth of human race, but in a more official and a more professional, conventional way, it was established actually in the middle of 70s, 1970s, when various members of Alcoholics Anonymous Society formed its own groups, and they actually developed some 12 steps towards sexual recovery from some individual issues which prompted them to be sexual addicted. So I'm very glad that you clarified this, because indeed it is a very gray area. Where is this a sexual addiction, but where it's just, let's say, high sexual appetite?
Yes, and the key word there really has to do with the consequences. In other words, somebody can enjoy drinking, but if they don't have any negative consequences, you know, if their health is not affected, if they don't drive drunk, this kind of thing, then they're not addicted. Addiction is all about negative consequences and how you can't stop. And so it's not the quantity, it's not how much sex you have or how much you're drinking. It's really, what is the cost to you? What's happening in your life? Is your life being adversely affected, but you can't stop? So it really is not about how much you do with something. It's all about what is happening to your life because of this.
It's an extremely clear separation between these two. And if I may just a little bit derail, capitalize on your extraordinarily clear sensitivity and the way you described your problems with your husband. Let's talk a little bit about sex expression, because conventionally we think that sex is an intercourse. But if I may be a little bit brave, just like you, and give my a little bit of a personal story, many, many years ago when I was younger, I had among male friends, and I have to say I was very fortunate because I was treated in the most of experiences as a woman. And that particular example somehow jumps now. I never had intimate intercourse with this particular individual. The reason I mentioned this, because he used to tell me that when I just touch your hand, I feel that we're having sex. And that was, frankly, extremely romantic. It didn't go any further, not because it was some kind of a problem, it's just that that particular time, moment, and individual interest, that was more than enough. So the reason I brought my own little story is because when I read this, when I read your book, A Little Bit Jumping Ahead, Surviving Disclosure, you're really developing a different sense, different meaning, and different connection to the meaning of sex. Physiology becomes more of an emotionally meaningful thing rather than just a quick, as you pointed, satisfaction, having a drug and having your quick fix. So the question is, do you see there is certain connection between the people who are emotionally terribly deprived and see only one way street of this physical self-gratification with sex?
Yes, there are people who are emotionally deprived, and so sex is like the only way to get love, and then you also have people who were physically or sexually abused in childhood. And the way they got love in childhood was because the person who was abusing them was being sexual with them. So part of treatment definitely has to do with looking at childhood issues. And, you know, I want to go back and say one thing which I didn't make clear. These are two books, and they're related. Disclosing Secrets is written for the addict from the addict's perspective about the addict's experiences and what the addict can expect to feel and to go through in disclosing what has happened to him or her. And the Surviving Disclosure, the other book, is for the partner. So the reason these are pairs, one is for the addict and one is for the partner, and both of them talk about this early part of recovery where you have to tell what's going on. And this reminds me of something else, which is one of the things that I found in my research with Deborah Corley on the disclosure process is that it's very typical for partners at the beginning to want to know everything. You know, I want every single detail. Did you go to bed with her in our bed? Things like that. Because partners often feel that if they only have enough information, then they will be able to somehow have control over the situation. But in fact, it turns out that it can be rather destructive to be told some things. Like, is it really going to help if you know that your husband had sex in your bed? I mean, every time you and your husband are lying in bed, you're going to be thinking that this is this other woman in the bed. So it's probably better not to know. So part of why we recommend having a counselor or a therapist organizing this whole process of disclosing is to try to help figure out what is helpful to tell or to be told and what is not helpful. So It's not easy, and we found out that there are definite things that are better unsaid and told in certain ways, and that's where having a professional involved can be very helpful.
or a certain timing when to say what. Maybe you do not, which is so clearly described in your book in various points. It's a timing. It's when you help your patient to have more and more self-awareness. You give this power back, if I may say, to have this clarification, because you have to have at least minimum self-confidence and a sense of self-awareness facing your issue in order to share it with someone else. I like to give you an opportunity now to tell our listeners where they can find your books and certainly your website. But before, I wanted to remind to our listeners that I have distinct pleasure to have an interview and our very frank dialogue with Dr. Jennifer Schneider. So please let us know where we can find you with your website, and even more importantly, where can we find your books?
Okay. The books, again, are called Disclosing Secrets, and that's for the addict. And the second one, the pair mate, is Surviving Disclosure, and that's for the partner. And they are both available probably most easily on Amazon.com online. And so that's where I'd recommend you can get them. They're available both in ebook form, and or else you can get a physical copy of the two books. And that's the place to get it. My website, where I have articles I've written on this subject and all kinds of information. My website is www.jenniferschneider.com. So you probably know how to spell Jennifer with two N's, and my last name, Schneider, is spelled Schneider. So the website is www.jenniferschneider.com. And the place to get the two books would be on Amazon.com.
Wonderful. And I certainly will ask you to repeat again this information. I like to comment on a book, Dr. Schneider. It's somewhat subconsciously important, especially when you read about something so sensitive and it becomes so close to your soul. The way book feels, the way it is going right to your mind, to your soul. And I wanted to congratulate you because the way these two books done, very poetic, if I would say. The last thing I would imagine, looking at the cover, that there will be a very heavy, deeply troublesome subject discussed in the book. If I can overcome limitations of the radio and share with my listeners that these books are done with such a taste, such elegance. It's a bluish, very free, spiritually, I would say, despondent sky with a magnificent, lovely water, and two stones, which I believe have physical feeling of a ricochet. And I would impose my own philosophical imagination to this. It's just hard to start to face that stone. But once you able to lift that stone, even if it is very little one, this is beginning of a very progressive journey to the relief and to the victory. I just couldn't help and not to share with you how beautifully designed your twin books are.
Oh, thank you so much, because Lena, you exactly have the thought that I had when I chose this cover, because I really wanted to make the point that even though in early disclosure it seems like your world is ending and like nothing can be okay again and it's just awful and you have to rethink everything about the past and kind of realize things were not as you thought they were, and it's just a very, very difficult time. But when you go through the process of disclosure and you get the help for yourself, both partners, the addict and the addict's partner, each needs help, you do come out at the other end. And I know hundreds of couples who have survived, not only survived, their marriage survived, their relationship, but they are so much better off. They feel so much better about themselves and each other than they did before. So it's exactly what we were trying to portray in these covers, kind of this optimism that things really, really can and will improve if you just go through these steps.
Certainly, you did invite with imagination, and that's an extremely comforting overture to these books. And when you put them side by side, you certainly see there is a continuation. We did touch upon parents because of the background. Let's connect a little bit to the subject, what to tell to kids. That's one of the chapter, I believe, in your book for Disclosing Secrets. Can you tell us how parents can handle this tragic secret?
Yes. Let me say that there is a chapter on what to tell the kids in each of the books. So if you only buy one of them, you'll still have the benefit of that information. And what we found out from research, from asking 100 couples or so what they told their kids and when and what the outcome was, basically the conclusion that we reached is you need to tell your children something, no matter what their age, because children are very sensitive. Mm-hmm. They know what's going on. Even if, for example, you don't say anything to the kids, they're going to sense if there's an atmosphere of anxiety and anger and tension in the home. And they are likely to think it's their fault because kids think that kind of the world revolves around them. And they're going to imagine things. And so you have to say something to them. Now, you have to do it in an age-appropriate way. And in the book, we discuss the way to talk to kids of different ages. When they're young, you can say to them something like, Mommy and Daddy have had some problems and we're getting help. And we go to see a doctor who can help us out, and we're going to meet with other people once a week to help get help for, and we are improving things for us. And this is nothing to do with you, and you haven't done anything wrong, and so forth. When they're older, you can tell them that it has to do with dad acted in ways he shouldn't have and hurt mom, and we're working on it. And then when they get to be older, you tell them more details. So the point is, you don't say, oh, everything's fine, and when it really isn't, because that can be very destructive to the children, and they are going to imagine what's going on. And also, kids overhear things. And if they know that it's being kept a secret, they may not say anything. But they may know quite a bit more than you think that they do. So it's really better to disclose to them in the right way.
I would say that your books are so useful to the families where there is no problem of sexual addictions. However, there are problems with other families. And children do bring certain stories from school to home. I, in fact, will be forgiven, bring another personal experience. In fact, I didn't even think about this until this very moment, because with the clarity, you explain how children need to be approached, and you triggered in my memory one experience with my own son when you indeed used a word overheard. My son was visibly in a very good school. It's not important that it was a private school, It was a good school because of the academic standard and very personal approach towards his child. And my son once came home very frustrated, totally confused, telling me that one of the teacher was accused of some kind of inappropriate sexual relationship with one of the older students. And he said, I do not want to go back to this school. I immediately had very subconscious reaction, which was not very clear. I could not articulate why, but I immediately disagreed with him. And we had a very long talk appropriate to his age at that time. He was a teenager. And I explained to him that there are several sides of life which are not very palatable, they're not very pretty, and there are some excesses and some unfortunate bad examples from adults. But this is life, and school is not to blame. It's a person who needs his help. Something in this nature, but I used, obviously, easier language with a more transparent description, et cetera, et cetera. I also use some musical examples because I believe you have to know your child well enough to know not only which wording to use, but how emotionally approach this child, perhaps with some description analogy according to his or her age. And, of course, I did not take my child out of the school. However, some parents did. The question which I like to ask you is something which I think we had once when we just for the first time had our conversation. Question regarding the family, because it is either root of the problem or it's a root for the solution. And unfortunately, in our society, family is so disintegrated that all this excessive problems and addictions, which are not only sexual, but some other forms of addictions, became extremely aggressive. Parents feel paralyzed, and parents the one who need to look at themselves first. Where and how this child could arrive to such a state of mind. So please, if you can comment on our families, what are the cavities there? Where do you see the hope and how these issues need to be approached?
Okay, I'll try. I'm not really exactly clear of what you're asking, but what I can say is that When an addict goes to treatment and they ask about their childhood, you often find out that the parents had similar addiction problems that were never talked about and never addressed. You know, a man who has multiple affairs and he's always on the internet, then he might find out that his father was very heavy into pornography. Even if the son never knew about this. And so what happens is that these things seem to be transferred from generation to generation, but you can stop that process by getting help for yourself and by being honest with the family and talking about it. And then the kids are less likely to grow up and end up with those same kind of problems. I mean, it really, the best thing you can do for your children is to get help for yourself. I'm talking about the adults in the family. And it really changes things in the family. It you start getting a family situation where there's more honesty and where there's better communication between the parents and the kids. And this can make a huge difference in the lives of your kids. And maybe you don't even realize it now because they're fairly small. But the kids really are affected by what goes on in the home, and it can end up coming back and causing them similar problems. So the best thing you can do for your children is to get some help for yourself if you've got some addiction problem.
You did answer it, even though I was not clear. you gave a very, very clear answer. And I like to take your answer and make a little connection, a little bridge to the brighter side of the story. One of the chapter of yours, which has to do with the special issues, you're talking about new love, friendship. And that really hit me right in the center of my curiosity. How would you describe the energy for new trust, new love, new friendships?
How would I, excuse me, I had trouble hearing you. How would I?
How would you describe, how would you advise to someone who will be nearly ready to face a new love, new friendship, and new sense of trust?
You're talking about the addict or the partner?
The addict.
The addict. Well, one of the things that an addict in recovery has to figure out is how to have a healthy new relationship and how to, well, what to tell the new partner about their past. I mean, that is a big issue, because such an important part of recovering from any addiction is to develop honesty, because so much of addiction is about lying and concealing what's going on. It becomes such a habit for addicts that they lie all the time about even little things. Let me just go back to something about that this reminds me of, which is when my husband had been in recovery for a couple of years, we were with friends, and he was telling him about something he did, some bad behavior, some, you know, inappropriate sexual behavior he had done before he was in recovery, and I was very angry. I mean, afterwards I said to him, how come you didn't tell me about this? I thought you told me everything. And he said, you know, I lied to you about so many things in those days that I don't even remember half of them, and I don't remember what I told you, and this is just an example of that, and it's probably going to be other times in the future when something will come up that I didn't tell you. And you, and all I can tell you is, since I got into recovery from my addiction, I have not lied to you. But before that, probably you're going to find out about other lies. So the point is, addicts, lying is such a part of their life that it goes on about everything. And so in recovery, honesty is a really key component. You can't keep some secrets and not others, and continue to keep secrets and lie about it. And so that also goes with a new relationship. And what we recommend in terms of telling somebody that you are a recovering sex addict is, don't tell him on the first date. You won't have a second date probably if you tell him on the first date. But when it starts getting serious, when you really care about this person and you're starting to think that this might be a long-term relationship, then you need to tell them about how you were in the past and about how you are a recovering sex addict or a recovering alcoholic or anything else, and that you are doing X, Y, and Z to keep on the straight and narrow, and that you're very committed to doing things differently in the future. And if you're with somebody that's beginning to care about you too, they're going to understand that and be grateful that you reveal this to them. So again, I'm not sure I answered your question, but
you certainly did, and I wanted to tell you that your husband is so fortunate to have you as a friend, as a, such a thoughtful scientist, and as a wife. I cannot start to imagine what you went through.
Well, it gave me the empathy, I think, and the interest that got me interested in doing research in this field and in writing about it, absolutely.
I just, before we will, very unwillingly to complete the discussion regarding your books and that subject, I just wanted to congratulate you on your honors. I mentioned before that it is I should say your titles, that it is not the titles which makes the meaning and accomplishment. It's an honor. And as I said in the beginning, that you have both So I like to share with the audience that indeed you have a tremendous background. You've been getting your bachelor at Cornell University. You've also been studying in human genetics from University of Michigan, having master and PhD program completed there. You have your MD from the University of Arizona College of Medicine. You also board certified in internal medicine, certified by the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And the last, you are a diplomat of the American Academy of Pain Management. This is just a remarkable group, remarkable family of your accomplishments. I very much like to go to another subject, which has to do with osteoporosis, something which I totally unexpectedly to myself discovered while I was learning about you and your books. But before we will go to that, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your education. Which are most memorable? What do you particularly remembering, and what was the most useful for your present research?
Well, it's interesting. I got into the addiction field because of my husband's addiction. I knew nothing about addiction back then, so I started learning about alcoholism. Nobody knew anything about sex addiction around 1980. So I learned about chemical dependence and became certified in it, and it was very useful because I had been a general internist until then. Obviously, I must have had a lot of patients who had addictions, especially alcohol and drugs, but I just didn't recognize it, and I didn't know what to do about it. So this was a very useful thing for my being a better doctor. And then because I was now knowledgeable about addiction, I started getting referral from other doctors of patients who had chronic pain, like chronic back pain or chronic headaches, and the doctors thought they must be drug addicts because they kept asking for strong pain medicines. And really the reason was because they were in a lot of pain. I ended up learning from my patients and becoming eventually certified in pain medicine, and that's what I did the last 20 years of my active clinical practice, was in treating chronic pain, especially knowing how to use narcotics for chronic pain. So I developed an unusual skill set because of my personal experience, and I was able to help a lot of people because of that. So I'm just very grateful for the way my life has turned out.
And we're so grateful that you are so knowledgeable about all this connected issue. I like to get into this area of osteoporosis, something which, as I said, I was caught by such a strong surprise, because you had, again, your own experience, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to make your story as detailed as you can, because osteoporosis, needless to say, is a scare to everyone, not only to women, but to men as well, and a confusion which is thriving in the world of drugs is just so monumental. And I was somewhat astonished when I read about your own personal experience. So please just tell us about this. I don't have a specific question because it's just an overwhelming experience from which we all can learn.
Sure. Well, in 2001, I was on a subway train in New York City, and as a train approached the station, it jolted, and I shifted my weight from one leg to another, and as I put my weight on the other leg, I suddenly felt and heard a big crack, and my femur, the strongest bone in the body, my thigh bone on one side, snapped in two. And I fell to the bottom of the subway train. Of course, I was in severe pain, and ended up in the hospital. And it was such an unknown thing back then in 2001 to have somebody break the strongest bone in their body just by some standing. I mean, it was unheard of. And it turned out that the reason was, it took years later before other cases came up and we found out the reason, but what it turned out was that in order to prevent osteoporosis, I didn't even have it. I had, like, in the early stages, which is called osteopenia. To prevent it, I had been put on a drug, which I took for 6 years. The drug was called Fosamax. That's the trade name, and the generic name is Alendronate. And this is the most commonly used drug in the U.S., probably in the world, to prevent and treat bone thinness, which is what osteoporosis is. It's bone thinness. And the purpose of it is, of course, to prevent fractures, because people whose bones are thin end up possibly breaking their bones. And so this drug's supposed to prevent that. So I couldn't understand how this drug, which is supposed to strengthen my bones, in fact resulted in my breaking my thigh bone from standing up. Eventually, I found out that there was a connection, and I started hearing from other women, mostly women, or some men, who had been on this drug and had the same experience. And I subsequently did research on this group. I started a support group, an email support group, which now has over 160 men and women, all of whom have fractured at least one of their femurs, thigh bones, 40% of whom fractured both, because this is a problem that can affect both of these thigh bones. And I've learned a lot. And one of the things I learned is that this drug, in about, it's not that common, but it's not all that rare, about 2 in 1,000 cases of people that have been on this drug and other drugs that are work the same way. There's now several of them. They're all called bisphosphonates. And these drugs all work the same way. People who've been on these drugs for more than 3 to 5 years have a likelihood of about 2 in 1,000 of having this horrible fracture, which often affects both legs, one after the other. And so now it's becoming known and more accepted that people shouldn't be on these drugs forever, that if you've been on it for 3 to 5 years, talk to your doctor about the possibility of stopping it, because at that point, there is this risk of fracturing one or both of the femurs. So if you're interested in more information about that, you can just Google femur fractures and my name, and you'll find a lot more information on that.
Yes. It is quite extraordinary. I wanted to thank you to voice your experience, to voice this such a powerful information regarding these particular drugs, especially because it is not a unique situation. We need to become almost our own clinicians, our own doctors, and to be extremely careful and mindful what are we trusting and what are we taking inside. And I certainly would say that would be another magnet to come to your website and to get your books. We are coming to the end, and I need to be very clear to our listeners where they can get your books. Again, if you kindly can repeat, and if you kindly can say the address of your website.
Okay. The books are Disclosing Secrets, and the subtitle of the book is An Addict's Guide for When, to Whom, and How Much to Reveal. So this is a book for the addict. And the partner book that goes with it is called Surviving Disclosure. And this is a partner's guide for healing the betrayal of intimate trust. Both of these books, Disclosing Secrets and Surviving Disclosure, are available online on Amazon.com, and you can buy them as e-books to put on your computer or your iPad, or you can get hard copies, physical copies, they call them these days, by getting on Amazon.com. There is articles and information about sex addiction, and also about these femur fractures and these drugs, bisphosphonates, on my website. And the website address is www.jenniferschneider.com. Schneider is S as in Sam, C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R. So it's www.jenniferschneider.com.
I would say that your personal experiences made this program so much more valuable, so much more memorable. I wanted to thank you so much for being in, as I said before, highly sensitive field, which are incredibly important and becoming every single day more and more important, because unfortunately these problems are not subsiding. If anything, they are getting bigger and greater. And particularly, I'm grateful that you found these keys to approach children and to approach parents who can and should communicate with their children. And this interconnection between different generations make these books incredibly valuable, not only with the people with sexual addiction, but the people who have to face those problems, people who want to find the answers. Dr. Schneider, thank you so, so much.
Well, you're very welcome. It's been very nice, Lena. And I just want to say that, you know, when bad things happen to you, one of the ways to help oneself get through those times and get over it really is to make some positive thing come out of it. And that's what I have been fortunate enough to be able to do in both of these areas, in writing about what I went through with having a husband who was having affairs and in what I went through for breaking my femur because of this drug. So by doing research and by writing about it and by talking to people about it, it's helped me get through those hard times.
Extremely important what you just said to get your own personal benefit by going through this process, by being honest with yourself, by helping others. We are helping ourselves.
Yes.
And perhaps if your time permits, we can meet again on the air, because of course there is an ocean of information in your book, and books, I should say. And also I wanted to send my personal regards to your partner, Ms. Deborah Corley, who also participated in the writing of your book. And perhaps if we can collaborate, we can have a program next time with two of you. Yeah. And you know, and have this even more complete discussion. Again, my gratitude. I wish you the best of the research, self satisfaction from what you give to people, to yourself, and this already happened 2013 year.
Thank you, Lena. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was my another program with a very distinct scientist, Dr. Jennifer Schneider, whose personal experience merged with her scientific interest, which has to do with a sexual addiction. I will wish you the best of the thoughts and realization of your hopes and this already coming into the action new year. Until next time, that was Lena Live. I'm Lena Mirmont, your host.